for the airplanes when they were approaching the airport. You know, you might have had maybe two planes approaching at the same time, and this way, using AM, you would have that ability. You wouldn't get locked out with capture effect on FM. Back to you, Roy.
KG2R1.
Yes, David?
Yeah, let's say you have two FM radios. You have two FM radios, two different kinds. One of them sounds much clearer than the other, you know. For audio output, you know, the final result is the audio that comes out of it. Like SSB, single sideband, you know, one radio sounds way clearer than the other, you know. And there's so many criteria that would determine all of that.
Yeah?
Yeah, you would be surprised anyway. One radio might cost the same as another radio, but it has certain features inside of it that give you a much more clear signal coming out than the other one. But it's still, for me, under experimentation.
Okay. So basically, the way I'm securing the question that I asked Ed, that is primarily a legacy one. There are a bunch of good reasons on top of legacy, but changeover and such is expensive and can possibly be dangerous, and so I certainly understand why FM would not be a good choice. You could probably make a case for single sideband depending upon the technology used, but yeah, okay. So it's primarily legacy with a lot of secondary reasons sprinkled in. So that's as good a reason I think I'm going to get. So thank you. Ed, any other points you would like to share with us?
Absolutely. I have a follow-on. Remember I said one word, Tenerife. I forget what it was, around late 70s, I believe. Tenerife, Canary Islands, was the biggest air disaster in history when two 747s basically collided on the ground because of a problem having to do with communications. There was a United 747 was taxiing out and had to cross the active runway. A KLM airplane was waiting for its turn to take off, and it was instructed to hold back until the United plane cleared the runway. And then something came up, they got all distracted, and apparently the KLM pilot was like the senior KLM pilot, brings up one of the major things that is a big deal now in air traffic control, is now the worst thing a pilot can do is this is co-pilot. Too many people have died because the pilot would not listen to his co-pilot and was telling him what a terrible mistake he made. And this happened with the KLM pilot. He starts his takeoff roll, violates procedure, says we are at takeoff, which is not a legitimate thing. You know what I'm saying about clarity? There are rules with everything you say on that radio. It's a matter of life and death. Let me delay, drop it on position. As the KLM plane starts going down the runway while the United plane is still crossing it, several people commented on the radio, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And all anybody heard was one loud heterodyne squeal from the beat note between all of the different radios, and nobody heard the coherent message that would have let air traffic control know to tell the KLM guy to stop this nonsense immediately. Had it been FM and had somebody captured the air traffic control receiver, it might have ended much better. Voice?
Okay, but I mean, that was, you'll admit that that's a very unusual situation, and hubris causing disaster, they've known that from the Greek tragedy time, so I'm sure that hubris continues to wreak havoc upon mankind, but that's a kind of an unusual situation. If you put it up against multiple signals where they might have dropped some kind of information unknowingly, and that could cause problems. So, you know, you can't go back in time and try a double-blind experiment, one using FM and the other using AM.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
He's absolutely right. I watched that program, Air Disasters. I forget what channel it comes on, but they described that that accident. And as I say, it was, you have to be very clear on your words. Certain words are permitted, and others are not. One other thing, on the over water comms, they are single sideband. I have heard Gander radio from New in a single sideband with over water comms. So most of those comms are single sideband. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a reason for that.
Okay, share with us that.
It is not the same level of communication. You are not, it is not so critical. You are not doing what they call swinging tin. That the planes are pretty well separated. Things are at a much more leisurely pace. It's not that critically important that the communication be absolutely perfect.
So basically, airplanes are equipped both for amplitude modulation and single sideband. Are there any other modes that are usually found in the cockpit?
Wait. No. The single sideband is done on HF when they're still a few hundred miles out over the horizon. No. When they're doing the usual air traffic control communication over AM, you know, they're within like 100 miles or so, maybe 200 tops. I mean, at 200 miles, at 40,000 feet, you're over the horizon. So it's 100 to 200 miles maximum, depending upon conditions. But beyond that, you can switch over to HF, which is really more for more mundane stuff, like talking to the airline office about stuff.
That's their version of a phone patch, I guess.
Yeah, you know, basically, air traffic control really doesn't care about you when you're over the ocean.
Okay, I could understand. They have enough trouble on their platter when you come into view for them. So I could understand why you're in the middle of the ocean. They're a little bit less likely to be concerned exactly with every detail going on with your life.
WA2CDM.
Yes, Andy.
Ed would appreciate this. Back in the early 80s, I was working for a company in Garden City called AAR Technical Service Center. I was working on aircraft electronics, and one of the pieces of equipment that I worked on many times was, and you probably know the number, the 618T, made by Collins, which was a single sideband press carrier transmitter that's used on aircraft, including the 490 S1 antenna tuner. Worked on many of those. Does that ring a bell?
618T, I know it intimately. Any ham would fall in love. It's the ultimate boat anchor radio.
Yes, it's channelized. The control head is a digital, it's a mechanical digital, because they didn't have LCDs or LED displays. It was a mechanical digit channel control head where you could dial in, and I don't quite remember, but I think down to the to the nearest 10 cycles or 100 cycles of a frequency, anywhere between 1.8 and 30 megs. Like you say, made a great HF transceiver.
And Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
Good evening. The transmissions I've monitored on HF for aircraft, even if they're around 5 megs region or wherever, always seem to use upper sideband. Is that a standard from 1.8 to 30, Andy?
Yeah, hi, Lou. Yeah, what I recall, yes. Although I don't quite remember the specific frequencies they used at the time, but as far as the transceiver is concerned, that covers the whole band, the whole HF band, at least up to 30 megs. That's what I recall. I don't own a 618T. Once in a while I wish I did, but I never bought one. You see them pop up on eBay, actually. Go ahead, Lou. I'm going to give it back to you and pass it around. Thanks.
There's a distinction between upper and lower, basically, so I've only heard upper. So I'm just wondering if they ever use lower. Let me turn back to Roy, back to that.
Okay, very good, Lou. Ed, any other points you want to cover?
The US 2M.
Go ahead, Paul.
So listen to the planes as well, and yeah, they were always upper. Remember reading somewhere that the only amateurs ever use the lower sideband for the HF. The rest of the world is just upper sideband. And it was really a question for Ed. I assume you can still hear these planes. They must be still doing this, you know, on those frequencies. Let's see, back to Roy, I guess.
No, you directed the question to Ed, so please, Ed.
In recent years, a lot of that sort of, you know, out over the middle of the ocean communication has moved to satellite. But you gotta realize, you know, satellite, basically, it's, you know, the satellite systems are kind of like pay-as-you-go, and they're not cheap. So a lot of outfits, like the airlines might keep in touch with their planes over the middle of the ocean, or they would use SSB and HF, because my ham radio is free. But I really do not know anything about the operating protocols. It's possible there's no need for a standard. That, like, for example, if Lufthansa wants to monitor their planes, they can make up their own standard. They don't have to be consistent with anybody else. They pick their own frequencies, they get their own allocations, use their own protocols. It's not like air traffic control where everything is incredibly rigidly controlled. Now, people don't appreciate, just coming back to regular air traffic control, people really don't appreciate just how precise and rigidly controlled everything about it is, having to do with communications and navigation. You can look up on the internet, you can pick an airport, and there is a page that a pilot will bring up. This is 2021. If you are a private pilot, you're going for a little joyride on a nice day, you don't have a clipboard strapped in you anymore. You have an iPad. And on that iPad, when you decide you're flying to a public airport, you bring up all an amazing amount of information about a public airport. For example, on one runway at a public airport, if you're doing a visual approach, you know, define, if you're doing a GPS approach, which I haven't even mentioned, by the way, you have to see the runway under particular conditions, so you're not allowed to land. If you're doing another kind, a VOR approach, there's a different number. Each runway, different conditions, has different numbers. there's all kinds of approaches. There's all kinds of points where you turn. There's all kinds of parameters, and it's different for every single airport. And it just goes on like this. And when you get, when you get on the radio, you have to be very, very precise. And if you are sloppy on the radio, when you land, you may be told to write down a phone number and call in, and you might get a talking to, and you might get the equivalent of a speeding ticket. And yeah, you could even lose your license if it's really egregious. And this is very, very, very carefully controlled. And if you listen, you can hear the amount of traffic is amazing. Okay, let me drop you. Once upon a time, before 9/11, I think it was United Airlines sometimes had a channel on their, you know, big seat entertainment system where you could hear, you know, the crew talking to air traffic control. And boy, did I love that. And I remember we were taxiing out to take, I had to change planes to Chicago O'Hare. And we're taxiing out to take off at peak hour. And there was this air traffic controller. It was like going nonstop. It was absolutely amazing. I remember it was a woman. And she would call the plane. They'd acknowledge. She'd give them a direction. They acknowledge it. Then they might have a question, and she'd give them some more. Then she'd go to the next plane. She was handling about 20 airplanes. And it was absolutely seamless and amazing. Think what else. Now, there are other things, too. Let me drop. Now, I haven't really gotten into the navigation stuff. Now you get into VOR, which is also on the aircraft, you know, 118 to 136 megahertz band, which is basically beacons that a map will tell you, and that's where the iPad strapped to your knee comes in handy, will tell you there is a VOR beacon on this frequency where you can find out what direction it is. There's also, some of them have what's known as DME, distance measuring equipment, so you can get what direction it is and how far away it is. Some have it, some planes have it, some beacon sites have it, some don't. It's a mix and match. But the bottom line is, you can fly a VOR approach, which means you're flying towards the beacon until you come into range for something else. There's also air traffic control terrestrial. It used to be on radar. They've moved over to what's called ADS-B, which is a whole story unto itself. But I will tell you, if you're interested, there are these various websites like FlightAware.com where you can watch planes flying around in real time based because their ADS-B transmissions are totally available, and these websites have volunteers who have receivers that couple in, so they have this whole worldwide network. You can follow planes all over the world based on ADS-B, which you couldn't do before because with the radar, you know, you had to have the radar to see what was going on. Now everybody can just listen in, and if you network them all, you can see what's going on. Roy?
Roy, have FlightAware.com. It's an app. You download the app. You sit in your backyard, and you look at the airplanes go by. And you can figure out which ones they are by looking at your phone.
I got a better one, Paul.
Better than FlightAware?
No, a better use of FlightAware. Sometimes when my son is going to do a cross-country recreational flight, he calls me up, gives me the tail number, because, you know, it's a rental plane. He deals with the school where he's dealing with. Gives me the tail number, I punch in tail number, and I watch him fly around.
Imagine so. Yeah, you can see every plane, then you click on it, you can figure out what kind of plane it is. It's a great website.
All right. Roy, ADS-B and stuff like that and going from radar control FF to ADS-B IFF is a whole different topic. I don't think you want to go into that now, but can I do what I'm going to call an eco commercial?
Certainly, Ed. Feel free.
Show of hands, not literally. PBS Frontline on Tuesday evening had something about the 737 MAX 8 fiasco. Did anybody on channel see it? I guess not. All right, no, so it's Roy. I know quite a bit about that. I actually gave a technical presentation with a PowerPoint presentation on that. And at the risk of sounding arrogant and hubris, I really think my presentation was better than the TV show.
I don't doubt it, Ed. We've sort of been following the 737 since the beginning of this disaster. If you remember, Hank, who is a licensed commercial pilot, discussed it with us numerous times on the technical net. So it's a mess. But I'm sure you could explain it better than the average talking head on cable news.
Oh, absolutely. But I have to admit that PBS, either Frontline or Nova, get some really good people. But I just wasn't that impressed. There really was nothing I didn't know, and there were a few things I felt that they didn't really emphasize. Do you want me to give you a one-minute summary?
Certainly, yes, please.
In aviation, redundancy is everything. Let me give you an analogy. Sounds completely crazy, but I'll explain it. Roy, you've heard of kicking the tires? You've heard that term on a vehicle, kicking the tires?
Yes, I have, Ed.
Here's what kicking the tires really is. Imagine you're driving your 18-wheeler. You're about to get on the road. You walk around it, and make it flat. The other three are holding it up. You really don't want to haul a full load, you know, a few hundred miles at highway speed with a flat tire. So what you do is you kick the tires. If your foot doesn't bounce off the tire, you know you got a problem. That is redundancy, backups, testing. Here I'm going, Detroit.
Yep. I mean, that was one of the first problems that was mentioned originally during this disaster. Their decision to not implement the backup system.
That's why I brought it up. We use the backup system. Whoever have your car start to run really lousy and the check engine light comes on, and it turns out your oxygen sensor failed, what it is a computer in your car knows when the oxygen sensor readings make no sense at all, and it goes to a default mode. The car will not run well, but you will get home or to your destination. Backup and redundancy. There's stuff like this all over the place. Why do we have two eyes? Why do we have two ears? God thinks of nature and redundancy. Now, here's the point. The 737 MAX 8 has two sensors. It's called an angle of attack sensor. It's basically a weather vane. You know the weather vanes with the rooster on top on farmhouses? It is a weather vane. It is a little wing. It looks like a tiny airplane wing sticking out of the side of the plane. And if they let you near the plane, it just flops around. It literally flops around in the breeze because it's telling you at what angle is the plane going through the air. the angle of attack is how the plane is going through the air. Which, by the way, is not that far from the so-called pitch of the aircraft. Pitch is relative to the surface of the Earth. Well, no. Pitch is relative to the sea level surface of the Earth. Even if you're flying over the mountains, if you were flying over the ocean, what would the angle be? And so angle of attack is pitch with a direction for, you know, updrafts and downdrafts. And this thing flops around in the breeze out there, and it turns out their so-called fix, the MCAS software fix, use that as a very major sensor. Now, they had two of them, one on each side of the plane. And in aviation, it's obvious when you have two of something, particularly in this day and age of everything being computerized, you generate a computer software protocol. Where if, let's say, one of them goes to full up, and the other one's reading a reasonable number, you just tell the crew, we lost one, and you switch over to the other one full time. And you can also use pitch as sort of a tiebreaker.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Sorry about that. Where did I fall off?
You dropped out about a minute ago. You're talking about using pitch.
So the idea being, with two of these sensors, you have the two sensors going to the computer, you bring in pitch. If one sensor obviously fails, you just switch over to the other one. If the computer can't make up its mind, it can use pitch as a type. Exactly right, but it's close enough to figure out which one died and which one's good. All right, so far so good, Roy?
Yep, I'm following.
For some reason, on the 737 MAX 8, there was none of that. No redundancy, no backup. And that's not... Now, what really, really burned me about that Frontline show on TV is they didn't point out. This is criminal. This is beyond... This never happened. This is mind-boggling that they had no redundancy, no backup at all. Now, what happened was... I'm going to drop. I'm whispering to my shot.
KG-2-1-1.
Hang on a sec, David. One is the sensor that they were using failed. It went to full up. The plane is going almost vertical up. And the computer puts it into a dive to bring it back down. Where in reality, it was going perfectly normal, and it goes into a full power dive towards the ground. David, did you want to say something?
No, I'll save my questions for next week. KG2RY.
All right, now there's part two. We should have it. Part two. The 737 has a computer that the MCAS function is powered up with. And there were two switches. One turns off the computers, including MCAS, which basically is, you know, you're taking away some autopilot. And the other one has to do with a basically power steering on what are called the trim tabs. Now, a plane has rudder and elevators. But the idea being, you don't want to have to fly, you know, constantly giving it some rudder or elevator to compensate for stuff. So they have little tweaks, trim tabs, to set it up so you're flying neutral. So the plane's flying fine with no pilot input. Well, those things on an airliner are power controlled, like power steering. And now, since the MAX 8, when you turn off the computer, you also turn off the power steering. Let me drop it, I'll tell you why it's a problem. What experienced airline pilots learn, because a runaway tab thing is you know, part of the normal train. But what it is, the first thing you're supposed to do if you have a runaway is you throttle back. And then there are, then you turn off the computer. But here's the point. They're now in Max 8, they're hooked together. If you turn off the computer, you're turning off the power steering, and if you don't throttle back, you're now in a power dive, and the airspeed makes it that human muscle power cannot move the tabs, and that's what happened with the two crashes.
Yeah, but that wasn't that discovered rather early? I mean, because all of this information, like I said, we chatted about, then it came to light that there were software problems even after they fixed all the other mess. That, you know, basically, everyone running the company should have been shown the way to the federal pen or something. It sounded like a ridiculous bunch of stupid things happened.
Yeah, now here's the interesting part. Why did it take so long to implement the fix? Yes or no, right? That's where you're going. Why did it take so long to fix this nonsense? That's what you're asking me, right? I have an answer.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. I assume it's going to be some variation of people covering their arses.
Worse than that. See, now, what they did is they did an exhaustive design review of everything, and it turned out these were just the fiascos that killed people. They found dozens of other similar fiascos, and they had to keep going through every one of them.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that's why later on there was discussion of numerous programming errors that had to be corrected, and they were going to delay things even worse. And so it makes a lot of sense that the same brilliant minds that conceived the original problem conceived a bunch of others that didn't quite kill everyone.
Exactly. And what I've heard is it actually originated when Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas. Apparently the reason McDonnell Douglas was up for sale because they got into trouble through short-sighted management. And Boeing, who has had a policy for literally 100 years, saying, we do things right, don't give us a hard time. And when they bought McDonnell Douglas, that got into trouble because they weren't following that rule. Somehow, when the dust settled, all the McDonnell Douglas people were in charge with that same failed philosophy. I am frankly surprised that Boeing is still in business.
Well, I regularly heard people recite the usual trope that they're too large to fail, or too allowed to fail.
Well, I will tell you, okay, one thing that the TV show on Tuesday said very well was that the FAA really didn't have the budget. Congress kept cutting their budget, and they didn't really have the budget, you know, be a watchdog over some places like Boeing and the like. And what they said was, you know, there is some mundane stuff. There are laws on stuff like toilets and exit signs. We don't need to be obsessive about that. We can trust Boeing to hire people to make sure they follow our rules and the like. But what happened was, Boeing kind of bent the rules until they were self-monitoring stuff that was critical for flight safety, which was an absolute no-no. And they kind of, they kind of lied to the FAA about stuff like that. That was one of the reasons why MCAS was supposed to be such a big top secret. And then when they got caught like that, the FAA has come down on them like a ton of bricks. and it's going to be a long time, I think, before FAA doesn't have FAA inspectors in their underwear.
I would hope so. I mean, the problem with government has always been the tick-tock of regulation. People want to loosen regulation because it strangles business. It's not good for business. Business takes care of business, all this other semi-nonsense. Then terrible things happen, and then it goes the other end of the extreme where they check everything. Then they grow tired of it, and they don't want to budget for it. And so you get the deregulatory people, and it's a never-ending back and forth. I don't think we're ever going to figure out what the proper position of regulation is supposed to be. It's just going to swing all the way to the right and all the way to the left.
Swing away from that. FAA is going to say, no. Look what happened the last time we tried this. And by the way, a totally separate case but indicative. There used to be a tennis star named Venus Jerulaitis. He died in a house fire out in the Hamptons. And it turns out it was because of something was done not the code. That he was staying in someone else's house and pulled a fast one on the town. And that's when the town inspector said, now you know why we do this nonsense. So it'll be that to the 100th power.
I hope so. I mean, there are situations where life really depends upon being obsessive compulsive. Space, aeronautics, you can go on and on and on. But the trouble is, again, talking heads on cable news, there's always going to be guys with wonderful reasons why deregulation is the best thing since buttered bread. It's inevitable. It may take a while, because memories take a while to fade, but they do fade. And, you know, the old canard about learn from history or history will repeat itself. We've seen history repeat itself.
By the way, it's WB2EAB. Have I monopolized this long enough? You want to get back to regular order?
Well, you know, we're coming almost to the time of SpaceNet report, so yeah, that's probably a good idea for tonight.
I just have one more question for Ed, WHCDO.
Good, Andy.
You just mentioned earlier about Chicago's O'Hare Airport, and it reminded me of a problem, or I should say disaster, that occurred many, many years ago. Maybe you could just verify. Wasn't there some plane that crashed near or around the Chicago O'Hare Airport that just either took off from that airport or was landing into the airport? I think this was back in the 70s, or maybe early 80s, and it was due to some communications problem. Do you recall that?
The communication problem that comes to mind was the Tenerife one. I don't know if you were on or not at the time. That was absolutely 100% communication. Chicago, I am pretty sure what you're talking about was a DC-10 crash. Now, there were two famous DC-10 crashes. One of them had to do with a cargo door coming off and breaking too much stuff on the way out. And another one was that an engine seized and completely ripped off the wing, taking all the hydraulics with it. So one of those two you think of.
Yeah, that one. The latter sounds like that's the one I was thinking of.
Yes. I believe that one was not absolute disaster. I think they were able to do a halfway decent crash landing, and a lot of people died, but at least some survived, if I remember right.
KG2 online.
Okay, Dave is making noise. What I visioned just at is I remember seeing a plane, I think it was over the airport, that was not in its normal position. Instead of the wings being parallel to the earth, I think the wings were perpendicular. In other words, the plane was tilted on its side before it crashed. I recall seeing a picture or video of that. That's probably the one you're talking about.
I'm not sure, but you got to realize that a lot of films, when somebody catches the plane just before it crashes on a film, much more often than not, you see stuff like that.
Okay. All right, very good. Let me let you go, because I know it's getting late, and Dave is out there also. All right, back to you, Ed, and give it to back to Roy.
Wanted and over Roy.
Okay, David, you wanted to say something?
To say that my father was in the Air Force in World War II, and he replaced radio transceivers inside the aircraft. So he installed them and took them out. He didn't fix them. What kind of radio was that?
HF was the ARC-5s that used to be available on surplus. The VHF, I'm not sure. Maybe the SDR-522?
I don't know. Maybe there was a few different kinds. But he didn't fix them. He only took out bad ones and installed good ones in their place.
Yeah, there are a lot of people doing stuff like that. My dad was the one who fixed the defective radar bomb sight.
I hear you. It's good to stay out of trouble, Ed, you know. And that was my question. Have a great night, KG2RY.
I was listening there.
Yes, Wesley.
Shortly for the discussion that we had a while ago, 407 kilohertz, 407 kilohertz, 25 watts, south of country. I can hear this beacon from here. Yeah, I was listening more to it. Yes, I can hear it. It's like S2. Yes, I can hear it. And it's right from the antenna, which is actually the ground. So my input of the receiver is connected to the ground and to X-ray.
Got it. Very good, Wesley.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we're coming up time for the SpaceNet report. It's 10:16 already, so I want to thank Ed for that wonderful discussion that we had about aeronautical locations and transmissions, and about the 737 MAX that we started talking about more than a year ago, and we'll probably be talking about it again. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I really appreciate it. I tell people regularly, it's you guys that make or break a technical net. You don't want to hear me soliloquize. So I appreciate it all. So I'll be back later on to tie everything to the SpaceNet report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. WS2N with the SpaceNet report. Name here is Paul. And yes, I could listen to Ed's airplane stories all night. That was very, very good, very well done. And I know he's a wealth of information when it comes to that. We're lucky to have him. But okay, history was made this week it started Wednesday night around 802, they launched the Operation 4 mission to orbit, which was three-day mission by four people that were not astronauts. So I know this is on the news and all, but, you know, there's probably a lot of information that that they didn't have, that if you, you know, if you look at certain websites, you can get it, some you can't. But anyway, the inspiration for mission, if you have Netflix, they have a documentary, the four-part documentary, and there's going to be a fifth part as well, and they had two parts on, and then a week later they had number three and four, and at the end of this month, on the 30th, they're going to have the fifth episode of the documentary. It's all dealing with the Inspiration mission. They basically really covered the people that were involved, not only the people that went up, but the people that were involved in picking them and how it all went. Anyway, it all started with this one guy, Jared Isaacman, and he's a billionaire, and he contacted Elon Musk a while back, and he said, you know, if you ever plan on sending civilians up, let me know, you know, maybe I could do something. And soon after that phone call, Elon let him know, yeah, sure, we'll do it. And that's why they had a commercial for the Super Bowl, and they were talking about Inspiration 4 mission. And people that watched it saw what they were planning, and the idea was to send four individuals up that were not astronauts. And this one fella, Jared Isaacman, you know, the billionaire, he's going to pay for the tickets. He's going to pay Elon Musk $200 million, roughly $50 million a shot, is what I've read, $50 million a seat. And, he, you know, he'll buy all four tickets, one for himself and then three others. With that, you know, the commercial went on, all you had to do was either send a video in or donate to St. Jude. The idea was to raise money for the St. Jude over in Tennessee, St. Jude Hospital for Children. And his goal was to actually raise $200 million for them. He himself kicked in $100 million, and he was hoping that by people donating, that was like buying your raffle ticket, you know, so you donate $10 and now you're in a raffle. That was one of the seats, and then eventually he figured out, you know, which person won out of all these people that was donating money. And it was this one fella that won, but he didn't want to go. He was, you know, he wasn't interested. But he said, you know, a good friend of his loves the space program. You know, can he give his ticket over to him? And they said yes. Sure enough, he was contacted by this Jared, and he got the okay to go on this mission. Jared also wanted somebody from St. Jude, because, you know, that's the hospital that they're really concentrating on. So he got a hold of the people at St. Jude, and they said, well, some people that we think would love to go. In this one case, Haley Arsenault was chosen. And, you know, you can see all this on this Netflix show called Countdown. And I just hope in the future that they take the same documentaries and take them off of Netflix, you know, maybe put on cable at least, you know, with maybe the Smithsonian Station or National Geographic or something. Because I think everybody should see this documentary. It's very well done. So it's just process of picking people. Another person that they picked was a 51-year-old lady with a doctorate, I think a doctorate in geology or something, Sion Proctor. She got picked to go up. Interesting story about her. They said on the show, and eventually, if you read about her, her father worked for NASA many years ago, and you know, they had moved, he had moved to Guam as a young guy, 19, 20 years old, and he was very good in electronics, and was one of the people that were involved with the radio, with the, well, it's really a radio telescope now, but the, you know, the big dish antenna that was part of the communications for the Apollo mission, and they actually needed that communications a lot, and one of the times Neil Armstrong was in trouble. Instant communications that was going through Guam. But now, after all the hullabaloo after landing on the moon and everything, Neil Armstrong would go around to different countries. And one of the places they went to was Guam, you know, of course, that's part of our country. He went there and he showed up, he met this fella, and he gave him a note signed by Neil Armstrong saying thank you and thanks for all your help. And all. So that stayed in that family forever. But now his daughter now is the Sion Proctor. Now she's 51 years old. She tells the story, and she, this part of the story she told in the video. One of the ways to get chosen was to send the video in. So that's what she did. Sent the video in with this kind of information, as well as, you know, she tried to sign up for NASA when she was younger many times, and made it through different levels. You know, you start off with, you know, 10,000 people, and they eventually work it down to 1,000. So she kept going down and down, and eventually, you know, she did not get chosen. But that was one of her goals. Anyway, she got picked to go on this mission, and she's taken that piece of paper that was signed by Neil Armstrong that was given to her father. She took that onto this flight. She said if she ever wanted to space, she would take that into space. So that's what happened there. They had these four people that took off last Wednesday at 8:02 from Launch Complex 39A in Florida, Cape Kennedy. And they went up, they said it was a three-day mission. It was actually 2 days and 18 hours. Successfully launched on a Falcon 9 rocket. The booster was used previously, twice before. So the booster was very reliable. In fact, that booster, when it separated from the rest of the vehicle, went back and landed on the drone ship out in the Atlantic Ocean to be reused again. So that was its third flight. The second stage, which is not reused, has one Merlin vacuum engine on it, and that fired up, and that sent Dragon to its destinated orbit, and then eventually that separated, and then the Dragon is on its own with four people inside the spacecraft, and they headed to an altitude higher than over 500 kilometers, which is higher than the International Space Station, you know, by far, about 100 miles higher than that, and in fact it was higher than the Hubble Space Telescope's orbit. And they stayed there for 3 days, and the inclination was, it was weird. I don't know why they did this, but they took the exact inclination of the International Space Station, which is 51.6 degrees. So all went well. One of the interesting changes to the Dragon spacecraft, it was used for a previous crew launch. SpaceX has launched three different crews now to the International Space Station. One last May, they launched the first mission. That just had two real astronauts on board, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. And they had docked with the space station, and then eventually came back and landed successfully in the Gulf of Mexico. And then another crew of four went up, and they spent 6 months on board, and now there's another crew up there right now. So, in fact, yeah, you also had a Dragon cargo vehicle attached to the space station. So when these people were up, you actually had three Dragon spacecraft actually in orbit around Earth, two attached to the space station, one cargo, one crew, and then the Inspiration mission as well, which was not planned to dock with the International Space Station. Because they weren't planning on docking with the space station, they were able to utilize the hatch. You open up the front cover of the International Space of the correction of the Dragon. When that opens up, it exposes a docking setup that's used to dock to the International Space Station. That wasn't needed, so they SpaceX removed that and they put it in this 3-meter diameter dome. They call it a cupola, and it protrudes from the vehicle. So when the front end opens up, which has to open up anyway, because one of the things that exposes when that opens up is four thrusters that's needed for the spacecraft. But, so that's always going to open up no matter what. So this time when it opened up, that it was a docking collar. They have this dome, this clear, looks like plexiglass type of material, but it's supposed to be three different layers, very thick, very strong. And each crew member is able to float inside this thing and stare out, look down at Earth, and you get a view. Almost similar to doing a spacewalk, you just look left, right, there's nothing obstructing your view. So they did that. SpaceX, I was worried about this thing, but they said it was really, it's very well done. In fact, they're going to take it out next time and put the docking collar back in, so it's going to be interchangeable if they ever do another flight like this. Those four Draco engines, when they fire, they're awfully close to this dome, this globe. So what they did is protective pica tiles, heat tiles, four of them around the circumference of this dome. And you can actually see that if you go to Roy's website, roy.ac2gs.com. It's so nice to put up all these pictures. Not one picture, he put up five of my pictures tonight. So it's pretty much in order. You get a chance to see what I'm talking about. If you look at the first picture, you'll see the crew access arm going out to the Dragon. That's what they would walk along. It's completely enclosed to enter the Dragon. Very nice daytime picture. That eventually pulls out of the way, about 45 degrees off from the rocket when it launches. And then the next picture is the launch itself. They had a nice picture of the launch. It looked like a time-lapse picture where you could see the trail of light going from Launch Complex 39A up to its 51.6 degree inclination. And the next picture shows the crew with their names. Now they're astronauts, of course. Before they went up, they were civilians. Then the next picture shows Haley Arsenault. By the way, she's a physician assistant over at St. Jude. So she works with the kids. When she was younger, she was a cancer survivor herself. You see that in the documentary. When she was young, 10 years old, with bad bone problems, they replaced her. Some kind of a bone in a leg, so it's actually a prosthetic, so she's the first person with a prosthetic to go up. She's also the youngest American to fly. She's 29 years old. It turns out to be a very successful mission. They were doing science up there. She was, because she's like a doctor, she was able to do medical experiments on the crew, which I was glad to see. They're going to bring back, test results, which are going to be open to the public. It's not one of these, it's a private company. They're going to, keep the information to themselves. All the medical information will be open source. So they were brought back to Earth yesterday for a successful landing in the Atlantic Ocean. Before landing, they're halfway around the Earth. What they do is they separate the trunk from the spacecraft. The trunk, right, has all solar cells and all kinds of equipment inside that feeds the crew. power, and, and especially they'll need that when they're going to deorbit, because, the truck, once that's exposed, that exposes the heat shield on the bottom of the Dragon vehicle. Those four Draco engines I told you about in the front, they're facing forward, so that they come on for about 15 minutes to slow the vehicle down from 17,500 miles an hour to a speed where it starts to actually deorbit into the Earth's atmosphere. Before it enters the atmosphere, that whole front nose is closed again. It's all on a hinge. It takes about 4 minutes to close that and locks it, seals its place, and then it enters the atmosphere. The outside of the vehicle heats up to around a little over 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and slows down from 17,000 miles an hour down to around, I think it's around 500 miles an hour, and then the drogues chutes pop out, two small parachutes pop out, slowing it down to around 250 miles an hour, and then those drogues chutes pull out four big, huge parachutes, and that whole system works. That slows it down all the way down to around 16 miles an hour right before it lands. They had great pictures. It was right on target, landed in the Atlantic Ocean. Hit the ocean. And they have it set up where, it doesn't hit the flat side first. It's on a slight angle to soften the blow when it hits the water. And, knowing the size of that vehicle, it looked like it probably went under the water around 10 feet and pops right back up again. And then within, it looked like 10 minutes, they had a rescue crews from SpaceX right on top of the vehicle. They make sure there's no hydrazine gas coming off from the 18 some odd thrusters that are involved on the Dragon spacecraft. And the crew is still in there, and then what happens is they hook up rigging equipment, and they bring in a ship called Go Navigator, which is a pretty large ship with crane-like set up in the back of it. Grabs a hold of Dragon, and that hydraulically brings it into the ship, lifts it right out of the water. Shortly after that, they open the door, bring out the crew, and they were in good shape. They walked off, went out there for longer periods of time. Sometimes they'll actually bring them out on a gurney, but all four people walked off. And with that, they go inside, they get a medical check, they got onto a helicopter, and they flew back to Florida. So that's a story on Inspiration 4. It was very well done. They went from originally when it was talked about possibly being like a joyride for billionaires. Now, this turned out to be, they turned into a real crew. They went on a crash course for 6 months learning how to do this stuff, flying. They flew in jet fighter planes, Russian MiG fighter jets. They flew in that. They went on to centrifuge where they spin up to high G forces. That was over in Pennsylvania. They climbed a mountain. They had to climb up. I think 9.5 hours. They set up a mountain to see if they if they could handle stress. And all worked out. Any questions on this before I move on? This is WS2N for the Space Network Report. Okay, anyway, you can go to roy.acctgs.com and see those five pictures. Each picture has what each picture is. And the last picture is the spacecraft actually hitting the water. The four parachutes above. That's the story on that. If you watch any kind of news yesterday, we had it on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News.
I suspect they probably had them on the other ones. Although maybe not. I think they would not interrupt the sports for that.
Another launch that will be going up is October 31st, roughly a little over a month from now. Another four-person mission to the International Space Station this time. This time they'll go to the space station. The last crew has nothing to do with NASA. As a taxpayer, we didn't pay 10 cents for that. But this one we will. They're going to be a six-month mission to the space station. You have a commander, Roger Chari. The pilot will be Tom Washburn. Kayla Barron will be the mission specialist, and also another mission specialist, Matthias Moore, I think his name is. Anyway, they'll be going up, and when they go up, they'll have 11 people flying in space at the same time, because there's 7 people on board the space station. By the way, when this Inspiration crew went up, for a short period of time, for a couple of days anyway, there were 14 people, a record for flying around in orbit. You had 7 people on the International Space Station, 4 people on the Inspiration 4 mission, and you also have 3 taconauts, they call them. That's the Chinese word for astronauts on board their space station. They have a space station now, and those 3 were on board. And the reason I say a short period of time, the day before Inspiration came back, crew of the Chinese space station also, they came back and landed in the Gobi Desert successfully in Mongolia. So they were up there for 3 months. They plan on sending another crew up shortly. Right now it's unmanned. They don't need to have a crew on board. So they had a record there for 14 days. 14 people flying in space, and now when this crew goes up at the end of October, you'll have again 11 people on board temporarily, and then that crew that's on board now, which consists of Shane Kimbrough, Megan MacArthur, and Akito Hoshi, he's from the Japanese Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, and Tomas Paquette, also from, he's not NASA, he's European Space Agency. Those 4 will be coming back. And anyway, the new crew that are going up, that I mentioned before, Moya, Washburn, Chari, and Barron, out of those 4, 50% of them are ham radio operators. Washburn is KE5HOC, and Kyler Barron is KI5LAL. Can't have enough hams in space. Let me drop it. Okay, anyway, before I move on, any comments or questions?
WB2BXL.
Good evening, Frank. Go ahead. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Like a lot of us here, following the Inspiration 4 mission. It sounds like they're really not sure how to brand it. They want to brand it as a science mission to try to get these folks some credentials and recognition for what they've done, and at the same time they're trying to brand it as space tourism to show how easy it is for anyone to go. So I don't know how that's going to play out. On a related question, do we know yet if any of them are going to be certified by the FAA as commercial astronauts? I would think the 2 pilots would, but not necessarily Haley and the other guy who flew it back, so to speak. Go ahead.
The latest was that the FAA would like to have them, you know, doing something, not just going for a ride. And because the commander and pilot, you know, they actually train them to some degree to fly this thing, although it's autonomous. They don't have to touch anything. They needed them as a backup. And Chris was doing science work, they said, because he's using some kind of a camera to take pictures, using his body as an experiment. It was, you know, I think they took blood and everything for, you know, anyway, I think they all were being used as guinea pigs. Haley was like, she's like the doctor on board, the physician's assistant in real life. So, and she, by the way, she works at St. Jude with all the kids. You know, I mean, if these people don't get astronaut wings, I think they all should for what they did. Put your neck out like that, you know, you, out of the clear blue sky, only 6 months of training. Then put yourself in a small room with it's just a little over 300 cubic feet with three other people. For a little over two and a half days, 2 days and 18 hours. And then to come through, you know, through the atmosphere and all. And then, you know, I mean, they feel the trunk separating, they feel the thrust is coming on. They certainly can feel the parachutes open up, and they should, certainly can feel when they hit the water. It must be some experience. I'm going to be looking forward to hearing their comments, right? But I think without a doubt, they deserve astronaut wings.
KG201.
Oh, yeah. Dave, is that you?
QSL, Paul. Hope you're having an excellent evening. I have a question about the civilian spacecraft that went up recently. You were talking about a charity.
Yes, the St. Jude charity. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about, you know, how St. Jude was benefited, even more so than just the publicity, you know?
I think it's great. You know, they're going to wind up with, their goal was for $200 million for that, you know, to be raised for St. Jude. Now, $200 million, Jared paid Elon Musk, launched these people. So $50 million a seat. And then Jared is paying another $100 million for to donate to St. Jude. And then money was being raised. And, you know, I kept looking at, you know, see how they were doing it. You know, the numbers were going up, you know, 10 million, 20, 30, 40. I think when they launched, they were up to 52 million or something. And then now they're already up to 60 million, you know, donations. So on top of Jared's money, so that's 160 million. Their goal was 200 million. So they were short by 40. And then just today, probably about, I don't know, I guess maybe 8 hours ago, I read that Elon Musk called up and said, put me down for $50 million, so that gets them over their number, $210 million to donate to that hospital, which I think is terrific. You know, they from what I understand, they don't charge anybody anything. Everything's done on donations. You know, you bring your kid in there and they work on them. One it's supposed to be a great facility. Back to you, Dave.
QSL, thank you for the details. It's a really great thing, Paul, KG2R1.
Very good, KG2RY. Let me see if I can get Frank back. I have to stand by a little longer for him to come through Echo Link. Let's try Frank.
Yeah, I'm still here, Paul. Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, my thought is that the FAA may split the difference and say, okay, the two guys who were trained to pilot the craft would get commercial astronaut licenses and the other two wouldn't qualify, which doesn't sound entirely fair. But, you know, I think that maybe one compromise. I'm also wondering if maybe somebody could petition the FAA to get some compromise, sort of like what the FCC and its predecessors did with the amateurs in the early part of the 20th century, is create some, amateur astronaut license, as well, that the passengers could qualify for, as well as the commercial astronaut license that the guys who actually flew the spacecraft would qualify for. Just a thought. Trying to think of a bunch of, some workable compromises on here. 7-3. Let me get back to the net. B2BXO.
B2BXO, WS2N. Very good, Frank. Thanks for your comments. I agree that somewhere down the line, if, when you start carrying dozens of passengers, some kind of second tier system will probably be implemented. SpaceX has ideas of eventually launching, let's say, Starship. His goal is to, go to Mars, thousands of starships. But one of his ideas is to fly, be able to fly from, let's say, from here to Australia or Japan or something. You launch 100 people here, and inside of no time you're on the other side of the Earth. In a half hour from now, and you'll see your landing, and it'll take you longer to get to and from the spaceport than it'll take you from to get from here to Australia. But, I could see putting 100 people on a thing at a time. And, you're going to have, I'm sure, pilots flying that thing. So they'll be called maybe astronauts, and then you'll have astronaut passengers or some other two-tier system, someday we'll get like that. You're going to have different categories, I guess. But didn't Richard Branson and Bezos? I thought they all got astronaut wings. These guys went suborbital for minutes, top speed of maybe up to close to 3,000 miles an hour, and that's it. These people got up to 17,500 miles an hour. They achieved orbit, spent days in space, eating and sleeping and. Even watching a movie or two, I heard. Sometimes once in a while, you're in darkness. 15 days in one day, 15 sunrises in one day. By the way, they have 15. The International Space Station has 16 days. Reason for that is they're higher up, so you're revolving around the Earth. In less time, if you're higher up, a couple hundred miles higher. So, I thought that was fascinating. So that's the story with that. One other topic I wanted to get to, not much time on this one, though, will be the OneWeb story. OneWeb is a company that's launching broadband satellites, just like SpaceX is launching the Starlink system, where they have a little over 1,600 satellites now in space. OneWeb only needs around 700 to do that. And they're up to 322 satellites. OneWeb launches around 30 at a time. They launch from different locations, South America, from French Guiana. They've launched from Voskhodsky in Russia, and then far eastern location of Russia. But, they're putting different satellites up, different inclinations. And they're very close to starting to get customers for their broadband system. But anyway, they launched recently another 30 satellites up. And so did SpaceX. They've been holding off for a while.